Michaela Simpson.
We need to celebrate.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
Like I said a little bit earlier, finding the right psychologist can sometimes be like speed dating. You meet, you ask a few questions of one another. Perhaps you offer a giggle to ease any awkwardness and hope that this time it's the right time. Well, for many Indigenous patients seeking professional help, finding the right psychologist comes with its own set of challenges. Questions like, are they culturally aware or even equipped to better understand what I am going through? Can they empathise with me and my experiences as an Aboriginal person? Sometimes Indigenous patients seeking treatment have been denied a voice and the reality of their situation. There are about 800,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia, but only 218 Indigenous psychologists. One of those Aboriginal psychologists pushing for more Indigenous people to be in this field is Adjunct Professor Tracy Westerman. This afternoon, she joins us to give an insight into why some Aboriginal patients may not be suited to non-Indigenous mental health professionals. And I spoke to her earlier. I asked her to begin by explaining what generational trauma is and why it is something being passed down through family members. And just a warning, this conversation will discuss children taking their lives and it may contain triggering topics that might cause you some discomfort.
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting field and it's a really exciting field in lots of ways because trauma effectively means that people unfortunately have more experiences of trauma than others. There is, and there's some emerging literature that now tells us, of course, that there is really strong evidence that that gets inherited into future generations. So that's something that people have dedicated reasonable amounts of time with. For example, you look at Vietnam vets, great example. They people have gone into situations of war, come back, and have actually found it really difficult for their equilibrium to come back to living in non-traumatic environments. And what often happens is you get altered as a result of being in traumatic environments, and often what that means is you see the world as more threatening than it actually is. And so the way I put it to people often is that there is threat that's imagined rather than real. And so what happens is physiologically your body is reacting at a greater level than the average person. Some people might know this to be the flight or fight response. And what that means is your brain tells you that things are threatening. And then, of course, at a basic level of the human condition is such that we need to protect ourselves and arm ourselves. So the flight or fight response gets activated by the brain saying there is threat imminent. And then everything goes to the parts of the body that it needs to go to in order to prepare your body to either defend itself, which means fight, or run away, which is flight. So it is a physiological reaction, but it starts with the brain actually processing the environment in a way that people are perceiving things as being threatening. I guess the interesting thing about this in relation to Aboriginal people is that there's some really interesting emerging literature that's telling us that racism actually impacts in the same way as a violent assault. So in fact, the impacts of racism for Aboriginal people can actually be traumatic in a way that people are actually physiologically having, changes in their body, and that can get passed down into future generations.
So what types of racism are you talking about that is creating this effect throughout generations?
I think there's a couple of layers to it. Some of it is just, an individual thing. So, for example, some people can have traumatic events and cope better than others with them, in the same way that some people have more conditioned ability to cope with just day-to-day experiences of racism. So there's an individual bit to it. But I guess in Australia, what we're really seeing, and particularly for your Northern Territory listeners, I guess, is that we have government policies that really now generationally, I think we've seen legislation that restricts the human rights of people. And the obvious thing in the Northern Territory is obviously the Northern Territory intervention. So what we're actually seeing there is that people can often, when people have human rights that are restricted, there's a very linear, I guess, direct correlation between that and lots of things such as, increasing rates of suicide, increasing rates of hopelessness and helplessness, and particularly We know, for example, that 30% of depression is actually accounted for by people's experiences of racism. I guess what that means is that if you have scenarios, for example, where people's human rights are restricted, then day to day, this sense of hopelessness and helplessness becomes reinforced by the fact that you have less rights than others, you don't have equal opportunity than to other people.
How do youth suicide and generational trauma actually connect to one another? What is that sort of factor that leads something from, you know, I guess, thought process to actual physical action to do something?
Yeah, I guess it's a really great question. I think what we're seeing through our research, we're really interested, obviously, in what are some of the causal pathways that can explain why we're seeing the suicide rates that we are, particularly amongst Indigenous people. Obviously, it's significantly higher than what we're seeing in mainstream overall. So what we actually did was we developed our own screening tools to figure out whether Aboriginal suicides look different to non-Aboriginal suicides, and we found that they were actually quite markedly different. Now, what we're seeing with Aboriginal people is a very, very clear causal pathway to suicide, whether it's attempt or suicide death, unfortunately, in some cases. And that is that often there's an interpersonal conflict or a relationship breakdown as a really predominant immediate trigger. What then happens from that is that people who become suicidal have this inability to self-soothe or calm self. Now, that's actually a very common thing with people that have compounded trauma. It's a bit like the lackey band that stretches itself so far that it can't spring back anymore. So when people have significant amounts of compounded trauma, whether it be through actual traumatic events or the impacts of racism, what that then means is their ability to actually self-soothe and calm relative to interpersonal conflict becomes more limited. And so there are particularly high-risk individuals. Not every single person is going to be like that. But what early screening enables us to do is obviously training and focusing on those people who are more vulnerable than others. So it's a very interesting trajectory or causal pathway that's very different to what we're seeing in non-Indigenous Australia, in that for Indigenous people, it's highly impulsive. It seems to be very quick. We've had, for example, horrible situations where young children have, had a conflict of some sort in their immediate family, and then they've gone off and ended their life. And it seems to be a really, really quick, highly impulsive. That's not to suggest that it's on a whim. It's not that at all. It's that what happens is it looks like they overreact to interpersonal conflict. And probably people know people like this in their own families, in their own communities, that some people just find it much more difficult than others to have coping strategies that enable themselves to bring themselves down, step outside of emotion, problem solve, effectively communicate, all those things that separate people who become suicidal from people who don't.
Yeah, even just yesterday here in the Top End in Darwin, I went to go catch my bus and there was, you know, some countrymen arguing and one was across the other side of the road. And, you know, one of the things that he said was he was swearing, but he's like, oh, I may as well just kill myself. And just the ease that he said that out loud was just shocking.
Yeah, and it becomes normalised. And I think that's where the environment comes in. So what we know, I guess, as psychologists is that there's two moderating influences. So you have the genetic component or the biological component, where there's some individuals that are more vulnerable than others. And then the next bit you have is the environment. So the environment are things like how people react to those individuals in their families, where they can either, can actually diffuse conflict in a way that they bring people down. They model appropriate ways of coping with stressful situations. So the environment actually enables them to develop skills based on what they're seeing in front of them. The other bit around environment is literally what I've already talked about, and that is that you have government policies that basically restrict the human rights of people. And so what happens is people, again, the sense of hopelessness and helplessness is a really strong predictor of suicide. So people don't feel as if, for example, I wake up tomorrow, my life's going to get any better. But when your race is actually part of that belief process, it becomes really difficult as psychologists and therapists to sort of get people to challenge that reality, because it gets reinforced every day through experiences of racism and those sorts of things.
And I mean, this is obviously where that self-soothing sort of responsibility comes in and really helps with people. I know that you've also spoken about attachment issues when it comes to self-soothing as well.
Yeah.
How do those two connect, and what's going through someone's mind when both of those have just totally, you know, been triggered by something?
Yeah, I guess the first thing is that we are who we are in terms of it's not necessarily in people's control. And that's a really challenging one. I think most people need to be a little bit more informed about attachment vulnerability, in that some of it's just bad luck. You just inherit it through a combination of genetics of your parents. Some of it is just, you know, bad environments sometimes. What we actually aim to do is bring that within people's control. And what we've found, I guess, with really exciting emerging literature, that's called neuroplasticity. And what that tells us is that if we do certain things, such as teaching people how to be more tolerant of certain emotions that they don't tolerate, and teach them repetition is what we talk about in relation to getting people tolerance for distress and being able to step outside of emotion, the brain actually goes back to normal. So it's actually quite exciting that people used to think, you know, when you have attachment issues and trauma-based issues, that there's not much that could be done about it, that that's just the way people were going to be for the rest of their lives. They were always going to struggle to deal with emotions in their environment. Now what we know is if we figure out which emotions people find the most challenging and develop distress tolerance skills when they're in those particular environments and so forth through lots of different techniques we use, then people can actually take control over those emotions and things can actually go back to normal. So it's exciting in that sense, but it's really hard work, I must say, and a lot of psychologists aren't necessarily that skilled, and mental health practitioners aren't necessarily that skilled in it. So that's why we're pushing this idea of people sort of understanding it a lot better.
On ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory, this afternoon we're joined by Adjunct Professor Tracy Westerman, and we're talking about the need for more Indigenous psychologists, just more Indigenous people in the mental health field when it comes to Aboriginal patients. And when it comes to psychologists who might not be, you know, adequately equipped to deal with somebody who is from an Aboriginal background or community,
it
brings up my next point, which is something that I love that you're so vocal about, and it's misdiagnosis in Aboriginal patients. I know you've spoken about patients being diagnosed with schizophrenia or psychosis. Can you just explain why that might happen?
Yeah, look, you know, I think what's happened, mental health is very much from a westernised perspective, and so even myself as an Aboriginal person, when I came down from the Pilbara, I was expecting all this training in Aboriginal culture, Aboriginal mental health, all these things, particularly given the rates that we're seeing around trauma and suicide. For 4 years of my degree, the word Aboriginal was not mentioned once. And then I ended up doing, you know, a master's degree and PhD. But that hasn't really changed in terms of the whole of Australia. So most people come out of universities and they are lucky to have an hour's worth of training in their degrees. So that really needs to be changed, because people are actually going out into communities with this expectation that they have all of this knowledge base. And suddenly I say it's tantamount to dropping someone into a completely different country when you go into an Aboriginal community. So there are all these things that are referred to as culture-bound syndromes that I've talked a lot about, but they trick you into thinking that someone has a mental illness, but really it's actually bound within the culture. So a great example would be, it's a very common, Aboriginal culture is very spiritual, so it's actually very common where people will have spiritual visits with someone who's passed on. Now, this is quite common in Indigenous cultures around the world, but the difficulty with that is, if you look at that through mainstream eyes, you can very quickly, through no fault of anything other than the fact that it's a different belief system, you can very quickly assume that someone is schizophrenic or psychotic. Now, we have rates of psychoses amongst Aboriginal people that are amongst the highest in the world. And what I'm finding across Australia with all the work that I do consistently is that people don't agree often with the diagnosis. There is something else going on, but they aren't necessarily guided around trying to figure out the difference between the two constructs. So it can be quite challenging for people.
Yeah, when I was in Alice, I was working with a girl. She was from Borroloola, and she would talk about her own mental health. And the way that she would describe it was she had a snake that was wrapped around her brain. And we, of course, knew what she was talking about. But I can understand how that might sound a little bit odd to someone who doesn't know culture or doesn't know just the language that people use to describe their own symptoms and how they're feeling. What is the impact that someone can have, or what's the impact on someone when they are misdiagnosed with something that's so extreme like psychosis or schizophrenia?
Oh, it's significant, actually. And I actually, you know, spend a lot of time obviously speaking to people who don't necessarily understand this field very well. And that's a big part about my job, is to educate the basic person in the street, because the more educated we get, the better. And so the thing I say to people all the time, is all roads lead to assessment. Every single road with all this complexity of this stuff leads to assessment. Get assessment wrong, get treatment wrong, you can actually make things worse. So, for example, if I have someone who I'm really clear is having a cultural-bound spiritual visit, the first thing I need to do is figure out, track back, what's actually been missed in the grief process. And often what will happen with Aboriginal people, it's not about the spiritual visits, it's about the fact that the spiritual visits are troubling. Now, if grief has been resolved, the visits should actually be comforting to people. And that's a really interesting difference between someone who's psychotic and someone who's experiencing a culture-bound grief. If you had someone who was psychotic, you'd be trying to get rid of the visits. But with Aboriginal people, what you're trying to do is you're trying to figure out what's causing the visits being troubling or impactful to the individual. And often what that means is they need to fix something in their cultural grieving process. Now, that's just one example of, if you treated someone as being psychotic or schizophrenic, you'd medicate them. And often what happens with us, we get called up all over Australia from people who have got the assessment or the diagnosis wrong. They've treated them as being psychotic, medicated them, and to the point that, you know, they'd been dosed up with antipsychotics to the point that they... Almost, one person said to me, you can almost hear them rattling, they've got so many pills in them. And it's not having an impact on the actual distress. So that's a great example of get the assessment wrong, get the treatment wrong, make things worse. And that's the case with mainstream as well, is that if you get the diagnosis wrong, then it's always the case that treatment becomes compromised, regardless of whether it's cultural, whether it's a clinical diagnosis.
Adjunct Professor Tracy Westerman joins us this afternoon on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory. We're having a discussion about the need for more Indigenous psychiatrists, psychologists, more mental health experts who are of Indigenous descent in this particular field. Earlier you mentioned that when you were doing your own studies back in your early days of this field, that there was no information about Aboriginal patients or Aboriginal people when it comes to the mental health conversation. Is that still missing from today's conversation that's happening around mental health?
Oh, look, it's getting better, most definitely, but we're still playing generational catch up here. And the reality of it is that as mental health practitioners or psychologists, whatever terminology you want to use, we're very big on evidence-based practice. Everything has to have evidence to support, so that the science always informs what you do with your clients, which is obviously clever, because you don't want it just to be clients to come in and see you and you're just randomly hoping that something's going to work. Everything has to have an evidence base to it. But evidence takes a long time to develop. So what you have to do is you have to test it and test it and test it, and then it becomes irrefutable, and then the scientific community accept it to be the case. The trouble with the Indigenous field is that there are so few of us. And so that's the problem, is that we are literally almost fighting against a system that's been around for decades and decades and decades, and has significantly more people that are creating evidence base that is not consistent with an Aboriginal worldview. So it can actually be really challenging, but we are getting there.
So how do we build up those numbers? I know that you offer a scholarship, but how else do we get those numbers, like, out there and in the fields and in the communities, like, helping people?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, look, ultimately I want, you know, every single state in Australia to have this, my Dr. Tracy Westerman Aboriginal Psychology Scholarship Program. So what we really need is hundreds and hundreds of Indigenous psychologists. But then the next bit too is that there needs to be, the universities across Australia really dropped the ball when it comes to ensuring that all practitioners, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, are trained in minimum standards of cultural competence in working with Aboriginal people. Because when you've got children as young as 10 that are choosing the option of death instead of life, this no longer becomes an Aboriginal responsibility. These are Australia's children. So there is a responsibility here on behalf of all Australians. And certainly what I'm saying is so much desire within the mental health profession. People are desperate to want to learn how to work with Aboriginal clients. I can't keep up with the demand in terms of my training workshops. So what that tells me is that Aboriginal psychologists, mental health practitioners are being sent out to remote communities where they're feeling pretty much culturally unsafe every day. So really, academic institutions have a significant responsibility here to ensure their training matches the statistics of what practitioners are dealing with, and they've really dropped the ball with that stuff, in my opinion.
One of the, I guess, sort of forgotten aspects of culture is that we've been around for over 60,000 years, so we've been dealing with mental health for over 60,000 years through traditional healing, through nunkeries. What role does traditional healing play in mental health in 2020?
Oh, look, I wish more, and I'm so glad you actually raised this, because, yeah, you're right. I mean, I always say to people that Aboriginal communities and people are the highest unpaid workforce in Australia. And that's where I get frustrated when people say, why aren't the Aboriginal community taking responsibility for and doing? And I say, we aren't just sitting on our hands, you know. Like, I travel around the entirety of this country, whether it's Palm Island, whether it's Doomadgee, whether it's Roebourne, whether it's, Alice Springs, wherever it is, people are getting, are interested in their communities. They're, getting pulled out of bed in the middle of the night with people in distress. They're 24/7 on their communities. Nunkery have always existed, and it's such an untapped area, whether it be through health or mental health. And I know years ago Congress had a great model where they'd, I'm not sure whether it's still going, but they did have a situation there where Nunkery were actually part of their service delivery model. And so people who had Nunkery who had expertise in mental health or drug and alcohol issues or whatever were actually incorporated within, the treatment options that were provided to clients. And that's something that just needs to be standard within Australia. And I think there's some really great stuff that's going on in South Australia at the moment. But, there's so much that we can learn from traditional healers. That's just 60,000 years, like I said, worth of knowledge in the brains of these people. It's just not being tapped into.
Absolutely. And, I mean, unfortunately, we're just going to have to keep waiting until, as you say, all that evidence continues to gather and come out and create systems that, instead of oppress people, actually help benefit them. In the meantime, how can we as Aboriginal people, whether we live in cities, whether we live in small towns or communities, how can we start better taking responsibility for our own mental health and the way that we might be acting or reacting to certain things?
I always say that, as counsellors or psychologists, we actually talk about this thing called insight. And insight basically means I have an understanding of my own vulnerabilities. I have an ability to actually tune in to the triggers within myself where I'm not coping very well, I'm not doing okay. All of us really struggle with insight, to be honest. Often what happens is people will just wake up and they'll feel reactive or ratty. People who don't end up in burnout or in terrible circumstances are the ones that are able to tune into that and communicate that to people around them. So I think some of it's that is just to be more tuned into self and then have all these beautiful things that you do. We call them self-soothing strategies, but just things for yourself that you have to feed yourself first. So I say this to my community model all the time. You can't be an exceptional mother, an exceptional sister, an exceptional father unless you love yourself first. And as Aboriginal people, we find it really, sometimes almost impossible to think of self because we are a collective culture. And so I do a lot of work with people around the self-affirmation, the self-esteem, the stuff that what's actually great about you that you can actually feed yourself. If you don't love yourself, you can't show love to your own children. You can't pass that down. And that's what the attachment stuff actually is. So often that's the thing that I find Aboriginal people, we find it really difficult to think of self. And so that would be a really important starting point, I think.
And then on the flip side of that, I guess my last sort of question is not just the territory, but speaking specifically about the territory, because I live here, it is a place which still has a really large amount of people who are racist. In the industry that I work in, I far too often hear, why can't they just get over it? Stop focusing on the past. Can you just break down how ignorant comments like this are and why they're not doing anything positive for anyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. It's dehumanising at best. It's not. I think sometimes people say, why can't they get over it? And that's why what I always try and do is I try and, when people are disconnected from Aboriginal people and culture, you'll often hear things like that, but they've probably never spent, the understanding and the connection just isn't there. But what I call it is, this technical term I call it is proximity to audience. And so often what happens is people have more empathy for people that they share more in common with. So if someone is the same background, colour, gender, all those things, then you have a greater level of empathy for their pain. So that's why that example I go with the Vietnam vets is a good one, because people will go to Anzac Day ceremonies. So the Sorry Day was a good example where people say, why should I have to feel sorry? The Anzac Day marches are a good juxtaposition to put people in that same proximity to audience understanding. They go to Anzac Day marches, but they weren't personally responsible for. So it's the same sort of thing that you know, Sorry Day is really around, I feel for your pain, because what happened shouldn't have happened. And so what happens often with Aboriginal people, there's this real disconnect that it becomes much easier for people to not walk a mile in someone's shoes, because there's just too much barrier between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal person in relation to understanding. And so things like, you know, these are Australia's children, that's why I say that, because if you say Aboriginal suicide, straight away there's a disconnect in terms of the capacity to feel the empathy at a greater level. But when you say these are Australia's children, people actually go, yeah, this could be my daughter, this could be my child. And that's what you want people to feel, that basic sense of empathy. But yeah, they're just, you know, I think it's very, very easy to make judgments of people's realities when you haven't lived in it. You know, so I think there is that significant disconnect we're seeing between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australia when you hear comments like that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the vet's point is like a really interesting way to broach the conversation with people who don't understand. It's almost like this automatic expectation that our vets will experience something like PTSD, but as soon
Absolutely.
As you bring up an Aboriginal person suffering that, they're like, well, why? They didn't do anything to justify them having that.
Yeah, but you can also, I mean, I do stuff on cultural competency training, and that involves making unconscious racism conscious to people. Yeah. And so there's a really powerful thing that I do where I show that John Howard refusing to apologise for the Stolen Generations, and people rank from 1 to 10 their emotional reaction. So 1 is no reaction, 10 is extreme reaction. And then what I do is I show the section on the rabbit-proof fence. Mm. So it's a minute or 2 minutes of high-level emotion, right, and you hold them in that, and then you show them the John Howard video refusing to apologise again, and the impacts on people are massive, because what that puts them into is a space of, this could be my child space, this could be my child being removed. And because there's so much misinformation that the Stolen Generations didn't happen and all these things, then of course people can't have that. It becomes more easier for people to disconnect it and to blame the people for their own circumstances rather than understand it.
That is adjunct Professor Tracy Westerman, who is also a psychologist, and she was talking to us this afternoon about why there needs to be more Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people in the mental health sector and field, offering counselling, offering services to fellow Indigenous people. And she touched on some really, really important parts of what actually goes on when some people do go and reach out for help but find themselves not getting what they'd hoped or what they'd almost expected. If you're an Indigenous person and you have an experience like this, you can get in contact with me this afternoon, 0487 991057. It's 19 to 3.